From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And for a third day in a row, President Trump took to Twitter today to comment on the big political story of the weekend, the New York Times Saturday night bombshell that White House counsel Don McGahn has given 30 hours of testimony to FBI special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Trump has been tweeting since then, saying he gave McGahn permission. He blasted the Times for implying that McGahn was, quote, a John Dean-type rat, perhaps a surprising choice of words. John Dean was President Nixon's White House counsel who cooperated with prosecutors in the Watergate investigation, telling them the truth about Nixon's attempts to cover up and obstruct justice. NBC senior politics editor Beth Fooey is here. Hi, Beth.
Hey, Robin.
And your thoughts on that tweet first. Dean told the truth. So it would seem that, in essence, the president is saying with his tweet, his guy, McGahn, wouldn't rat him out, wouldn't tell the truth?
Well, as we all know, President Trump prizes loyalty pretty much over everything. And the point he's been trying to make all weekend long is to say, I gave my White House counsel, Don McGahn, permission to do this. I want transparency. I said he can go ahead and do this. So he's trying to frame it all as though, because it was something that he agreed to, Don McGahn is just acting in his stead and is representing him now to the Mueller probe in a way that is going to be beneficial to Trump. It seems that over the course of the weekend, you could sort of tell the way that the tweets kind of ratcheted it up, particularly with that second New York Times story suggesting that Trump and his team don't really know what McGahn gave to the special counsel team, that perhaps it wasn't all beneficial to the president. And perhaps, indeed, Don McGahn is trying to protect himself a bit here. And it wasn't just him representing the president in a way that is just going to benefit the president's position. So I think that's why we started to see the president get quite agitated over Twitter over the course of the last couple of days.
Well, the Times also reported that McGahn was surprised by Trump's decision to allow the testimony because McGahn and his lawyer thought it was a trick so that McGahn would take the fall for obstruction of justice. The Times implying there that you would have to tell the truth. You have to tell the truth when you go before these. And he would be seen as obstructing justice if he didn't.
Right. He wants to avoid the fate of John Dean. John Dean did serve prison time for his role in obstruction of justice during the Watergate scandal, although he did as well become a key prosecution witness. Look, it's clear that the strategy out of the Trump legal team has changed quite a bit since the days where McGahn and his lawyer discussed it and agreed to go ahead and sit down with the special counsel. That was all devised by his President Trump's former team of lawyers, Ty Cobb and John Dowd. They felt that by laying everything out there, being as transparent, so to speak, as possible, the special counsel investigation would wrap right up and everything would proceed from there and Trump could get on with his presidency. That has obviously changed since those two lawyers stepped down and Rudy Giuliani and Jay Sekulow have stepped into the role of being the lead counsels. And they've been much more combative toward Mueller's probe. They've been much more tough. And President Trump has also ramped up the rhetoric in that time. So what McGahn did was a representation of a legal strategy that has been completely jettisoned at this point.
Well, hey, you mentioned Rudy Giuliani over the weekend. He also raised eyebrows when he said something about the truth isn't the truth. And what he was trying to say inelegantly was that James Comey has one version of the truth and Donald Trump has another. So who decides what the truth is? But they are talking again about whether or not President Trump should speak to Mueller in the investigation. Do you think that's why, you know, I was wondering, why was this leaked out about the counsel McGahn now? Is this a part of that debate, you know, forcing the president to come speak to Mueller?
Well, it would appear to be a way to kind of pigeonhole the president now too, that he really has no choice but to give his version of events, because Don McGahn's version is the main version that is representing Trump at this point. 30 hours worth of testimony, we understand,
and the president is no longer sure of what that testimony is.
Exactly, and so if he wants to correct the record or to have his version of events stand at all in comparison to Don McGahn's, he would presumably have to go ahead and speak to Mueller. I mean, that was a point that Chuck Todd on Meet the Press made to Rudy Giuliani yesterday, doesn't this force him to do so?
Real quick question, Beth. Can't the president just ask McGahn, or does he have to tell him what he said?
Well, it seems a little embarrassing that the president and his legal team were caught a little bit off guard by this, by not knowing what Don McGahn told Mueller's team. So that's certainly going on at this point. But the record is already there. He's already given that testimony. Right. That can't change.
Beth Fooey, NBC senior politics editor. Thanks as always.
You bet.
Today marks 30 years since the end of the Iran-Iraq War. Saddam Hussein launched the conflict against Iran's new Shia Islamic Republic in 1980 after the Iranian Revolution. And by the time the war ended in 1988, more than 1 million troops and civilians were dead. Joining us now is Borzu Deragahi, a journalist and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. And Borzu, we forget in the West that so many people died in this war. Remind us what it was about.
Tensions between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Iran had been building for years over various disputes. It was really about who's the big kid on the block when it comes to the Persian Gulf. And once the revolution took place in Iran in 78-79, Saddam Hussein won. He saw an opportunity to take on a weakened Iran. And two, he was worried that the revolution in Iran, which was rooted in Shia Islam, would spread to the majority Shia population of his country. And so he made a preemptive strike and invaded Iran.
Now, the global alliances here, perhaps not surprisingly, are muddied. The United States publicly supported Iraq with intelligence and money. President Reagan said that the U.S. could not afford to let Iran win this war. But on the other hand, this is also the time of the Iran-Contra controversy. The United States was indirectly supplying arms to Iran. So tell us about the alliances here and where the United States sat.
Well, I think that the Iran-Contra issue was sort of an anomaly, kind of a bizarre scam that took place with some freelancers in Washington with the approval of the top levels of the Reagan administration. But generally, the alliances, and this is what I think is still really important about this war, the alliances are the alliances that are in place now. You had the Saudis and the Emiratis and the U.S. and much of the West supporting Saddam Hussein, while you had, the Syrian regime and to some extent China supporting the Iranian government. Mm. And, Russia at the time was a backer of the Saddam regime. So it really shaped the region to a certain extent. It created the alliances that endure to this day.
There are also other hints of things that we see today, which is chemical weapons played an important role in this war. What can you tell us about that?
I think that is another interesting aspect of the war. Saddam Hussein repeatedly used chemical weapons against the Iranian troops during the war. And Iran went to the UN, went to international bodies and said, hey, Saddam Hussein is doing this to us. And the UN and the other international bodies, including the U.S., didn't do much. And so this launched the impetus within the Iranian regime. And, maybe some people would disagree with me, but I've looked into this. This launched the impetus for what later became the Iranian nuclear program. Hmm. Because it was at that time, really, with these the use of weapons of mass destruction against the Iranian government, against the Iranian troops, that the Iranian government at that time, the Islamic Republic, decided that it would be a good idea to start pursuing their own weapons of mass destruction.
Huh. And by the way, is it right that the technology that the United States gave to Saddam Hussein eventually helped him develop some of the chemical and biological weapons that he was using?
I think that definitely, yes. I think that the West played a role in the chemical weapons that he used. And later on, the worries he created about chemical weapons and biological weapons, that includes the U.S., that includes Germany, and so on. So, in the eyes of many in the region, it was the West that armed Iraq with the chemical weapons that later the Bush administration said that, were the raison d'etre for its an invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Tangled web there for sure. 30 years later, Borzu, can you draw a line from the end of the Iran-Iraq war in 1988 to what the Middle East looks like today? What does it teach us?
The end of the Iran-Iraq war left, an inconclusive end to the conflict in the region. Iraq was impoverished from the war, even though it hadn't lost. That was one of the reasons, one of the main reasons it decided to invade Kuwait. And that led ultimately from 1991, the first Gulf War to liberate Kuwait, to the second Gulf War to invade, occupy, and, you know, change Iraq. And as we know, it was the change of regime in Iraq that gave Iran the opportunity to expand its reach and become the larger regional power that it is now. And it also was the invasion of Iraq that unleashed al-Qaeda in Iraq, which later became ISIS.
And yet we don't really talk about the Iran-Iraq war that often, especially in the context of everything else that's happening there now. Borzu Dirigahi, Senior Fellow with the Atlantic Council, thanks so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
At one point in a National Geographic documentary about world-famous chimpanzee expert Jane Goodall, we see delightful film of her as a child, dressing her dog for tea, setting up her stuffed animals on the lawn, daydreaming about going to Africa to be with real animals and Tarzan. Instead, she became Jane, a superstar still in her 20s, interviewed often about the dangerousness of living with chimpanzees.
Sometimes I was frightened, especially of things like leopards. But it was the kind of life I'd always dreamed of myself living. And it was so fascinating that nothing could deter me.
The film, with a score from Philip Glass, directed by Brett Morgan, is nominated for 7 Emmy Awards and is available on DVD and through Sunday, streamed free through the National Geographic website. We'll link you at herenow.org. And it's thrilling in that it includes recently discovered footage of Goodall as the 26-year-old former waitress and secretary to researcher Louis Leakey, who picked her to go to the Gombe Wilderness in Tanzania to study chimpanzees, precisely because she hadn't gone to university, didn't know anything about the subject, and so might have an open mind, which she soon used to upend the scientific world's accepted thinking that animals are not capable of rational thought, when she saw that, in fact, chimpanzees use tools. The film is called Jane. To many of us, she is, just like Cher, a single-named heroine. And Jane Goodall joins us now. Welcome back.
Hello. Well, lovely speaking with you.
To see you in this early, recently discovered footage, so young, so sure of yourself, what was it like for you to see that footage?
First of all, I think that Brett Morgan has done an incredible job. He's produced a documentary which, out of all those I've seen of me and the chimps, this is the only one that actually takes me right back into the skin of my 26-year-old self. It's a feeling of attaining a dream, but also the sense of despair that I sometimes felt because the chimps were just running away from me. And then feelings of great excitement when I saw the first chimp to lose his fear, David Greybeard, not only using twigs to fish termites from their nest, but actually making tools by stripping leaves and side branches.
Few people had even seen them, as you point out, just a couple researchers, and one was sort of a crazy guy who covered himself in baboon poop. What was it like when you first saw this community?
Well, it took a long time,
yeah.
You know, because they'd never seen a white ape before, and we are the fifth ape, actually. So it was gradual. It was getting to learn one member and then another, until gradually I realized these amazing beings live in communities, and gradually learning they all had their own personalities and that they had strong family bonds. I mean, the whole thing was a gradual unfolding, and the more it unfolded, the more fascinating it became.
Oh, I mean, the more we see their human characteristics. Talk about this footage shot by a man who joined you after some of your discoveries. It was thought, well, maybe we ought to send a photographer there. She seems to be doing okay. And this was Dutch filmmaker Hugo van Lawick. What we're seeing through his footage is not only you falling in love with the chimpanzees, but you and he falling in love with each other. So there are two love stories here, you know, you and the chimps and you and your first husband. Then a third love entered for each of you. He was becoming one of the great nature photographers. He needed to be in the Serengeti. He wanted you there with him. You knew you had to be with the chimpanzees. Was that difficult for you to watch that story unfold?
Well, it was, you know, even at the time, it was very sad.
Yeah.
But there was nothing we seemed able to do to make it work. And it was particularly sad for our son. But we made the best of it, and Hugo and I stayed friends. So I think the outcome was the only thing that could have happened.
Yeah. Well, but what we're watching is not just how difficult it is for people who have passions to follow that passion, but for a woman to want to put her work first, especially in the 60s, 70s?
Well, you know, most women weren't even thinking in terms of careers. So you did something for a little while, and then you got married and raised a family. And so I was trying to do it all.
Well, it also seems that you were learning a lot about parenting from the chimpanzees, one in particular, Flo. You watched her have her baby, Flint. You had your son, you know, after that. As Flint grows older, you watch, he's unable to detach from her. It's so painful. After that is when you send your son back to school in England with your mom. It's almost like you were watching a young chimp not able to separate from a mother, and you knew you had to teach your son how to.
It sometimes sounds a bit brutal, sending him off to England. Well, I sent him off to my family because I'd been homeschooling him, and I couldn't go on doing that. What I learned from Flo was the importance of supporting your child. Even if your baby had a fight with an infant whose mother was dominant, your mother, if she's supportive, will rush in to help you, even though she knows she's going to get beaten up. Mm-hmm. And that's what my mother did for me when I had this dream of Africa. She was the only one who supported me. Everybody else laughed and said, get real, dream about something you can achieve. Mm. You'll never get to Africa. It's far away, and you're only a girl.
Mm. Flo also seems to teach you about dying. It's heartbreaking, but we see she's died crossing a stream. She's elderly. The little son, it's a heartbreaking point in the film, but you comment on that you kind of learned from her what you want, to be allowed to just go when you are too old to carry on.
Well, I think when you live out in the wild, whether you're studying chimpanzees, birds, or anything, birth and death become a part of the natural order of things. And then the terrible polio epidemic, truly heartbreaking.
Polio brought by humans to another part of Africa, infecting these animals. Oh, and to see them dragging limbs, terrible.
It was awful. And the thing is that chimps are so like us, biologically as well as behaviorally, that they can catch all our known human contagious diseases.
Well, this, in fact, changes the way people can research chimpanzees, because back in the day when you first started, you could be hugging them, you could be grooming them, let them groom you. And yet, do I understand that's not allowed now?
No, because we now know so much more about, you know, the danger that humans pose, and we don't allow people to get too close, although you can't stop the chimps coming up and the babies wanting to touch people, and the males sometimes giving you a swipe as they display paws.
Yeah.
So, but we do our best. And I'm just glad that at the time when I went out, none of this was known. And it was very common for scientists at the beginning of studying primates to set up feeding stations.
This was when you noticed that a chimp would come and take a banana from your tent. So the idea was, well, maybe we have bananas here for them. Again, try to get a closeness. But they became crazed then for the bananas. They trashed the camp. Let's just listen to a little bit of the sound. I mean, this was really hard to watch, Jane Goodall. I mean, it was frightening. You had to take refuge. It's part of your learning curve. You know, how do we do this so that it's safe for them, safe for us? Did you ever question, what am I doing? I've entered their world to study it, but I've altered it.
Not really. Of course, there's criticism of this. But I was always, from the very beginning, interested not so much in the natural behavior, how far do they travel, and so on. I was interested in the difference between individuals. And within this setting, one, the bananas enabled Hugo to get the pictures, which kept the National Geographic interested, so they kept on funding it. Secondly, within that setting, it was possible to observe the differences in the way that the different individuals interacted with each other and coped with this situation.
And that scene with the bananas, you know, reminds us, as does another one I want to listen to a little bit, you know, that these are animals, as someone said, that can rip your face off if they wanted to. After a group of the chimps decides to move to another area, suddenly there's just civil war as the first group attacks them. Let's just listen to a little of that.
The entire community that moved south was annihilated.
It seems like at this point you realize they're all too human.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I thought they were like us, but nicer. And then when that, what amounted to primitive war, it shocked me, showing they too have a dark and brutal side.
Jane Goodall, you are 84, going strong.
Well, I'm 300 days a year on the road. I'm talking about what we're doing to our planet, how we're destroying the forest, we're polluting the ocean and the air and the rivers. I have to work with young people today so that we try and raise new generations to look after this poor old planet better than we have before it's too late.
That's Jane Goodall, the focus of the National Geographic documentary, Jane. Jane Goodall, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Ah, to see her in this newly discovered footage at 26, marching off into the jungle with just her Converse sneakers and shorts. She says she knew part of the interest in her was in her long legs, and that was sexist, but she used it for all it was worth to get attention and funding. Starting tonight through Sunday, the documentary Jane will be streamed free through the National Geographic website. We will link you up at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Barbershops can be communal gathering spots, great for gossip and real local news. And one barbershop in Cleveland is also becoming a hub for health. Gabriel Kramer from WCPN IdeaStream explains.
At the Urban Cuts Barbershop in West Cleveland, customers come in for a haircut and maybe some friendly sports banter.
I think we go win, but I don't know if we go sweep.
I chose the money talking to him, man.
Yeah, I am, when it's in my favor.
But when Philip Parker came to get a trim, he also got some good news.
So your blood pressure is perfect. So like we said before, the goal is less than 120 and less than 80. It's perfect. It's perfect. No, it's perfect.
Every so often, Urban Cuts, that's KUTZ Cuts, offers free blood pressure screenings for its customers.
I think it was excellent. It was something that's needed in the community.
Parker admits that it's been a while since he's gotten his blood pressure checked.
Oh, it's been some years. So that's real convenient for me.
A 2017 study by the American Heart Association shows that about 60% of African-American males have high blood pressure. For white and Hispanic males, less than 50%. So who is the mastermind behind bringing health into the mix at a place where sports, music, and politics dominate the discussion?
Have you noticed a change, like, in your energy or anything like that?
That would be Waverly Willis, the owner of Urban Cuts.
My clients were starting to disappear, and when I would run into their wives or their children or their girlfriend, I would ask what happened to Joe, and they would tell me that he passed away from a stroke or a heart attack, something to that.
Willis wanted to help, partially because he has his own history of blood pressure problems.
I lost 200 pounds in the last couple of years. I was able to get off of the high blood pressure medication, which was one of my goals.
Willis started this program a few years ago by asking medical professionals he knew personally to lend a hand. Then he partnered with Cleveland's American Heart Association to make the process more formal. Brenda Parks is the Multicultural Initiatives Director.
It's an ideal location for people to come and to learn, mainly because people trust their barber. And because they trust their barber, they're more likely to, you know, explain or share information that they wouldn't normally share with anyone else.
Yeah, it's actually been a couple of occasions that guys have came in to get a basic service, haircut, lineup, or whatever. A couple times, gentlemen's their blood pressure was so high, that so elevated, that we told them to skip the haircut and go to the emergency room.
Willis also founded the Urban Barber Association, a network of Cleveland-area barbershops and salons working together to educate customers on community issues.
I don't want it to be strange to know that you can get your blood pressure taken at a barbershop. It's more barbershops than hospitals. It's more barbershops than urgent cares. So why not use these small satellites as beacons of hope and a resource center in our community?
Thanks to Willis, four other barbershops and salons in Cleveland now provide blood pressure screenings. He hopes to double that number next year. For Here and Now, I'm Gabriel Kramer in Cleveland.
When economic bubbles burst, recessions usually follow. In 2001, it was technology stocks. 7 years later, home loans and mortgage-backed securities. Could the next bubble be corporate debt? Joining us now is William Cohan, an author and former investment banker. Bill, you recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times waving a flag about this, so let's define the problem. We're talking about the $41 trillion corporate bond market, which is bigger than the stock market. Why are so many companies going into debt by issuing these bonds, and who's buying them up?
Sure. I mean, corporations issue bonds to borrow money all the time. They borrow it in the loan market from big banks, who then turn around and syndicate those loans or sell them off to investors all around the world. They issue bonds in the corporate bond market, which is just a security that is then sold as an investment all around the world. And because the Federal Reserve intentionally kept interest rates so low, their so-called zero interest rate policy from, say, 2008 to 2016, investors around the world were very hungry for yield, higher paying bond instruments or loans than they could find in the government treasury market.
And we're talking about individual investors, but also big ones like pension funds, mutual funds, things like that.
Yes. I mean, pension funds, mutual funds, individual investors, college endowments, people, firemen, policemen, people who have their pensions invested, teachers in these kinds of bonds, which they would presume are safe and secure. And, you know, by and large, they are. But unfortunately, what has happened in the 8 years between 2008 and 2016 is that this demand for yield and higher yields drove up the price of bonds. So people were overpaying for bonds in order to get what they thought was a higher yield. Mm. And, you know, that does come back to haunt people, which is why I wanted to write this piece.
All right, let's get specific. You do write about a few companies in that piece, and one is Asurion. It's a cell phone insurance company. You go to them, you buy an insurance plan for your cell phone. What's happening with Asurion?
Well, Asurion is kind of a remarkable company. It is sort of famous on Wall Street for being a small company that was found by a bunch of little and small investors, and it's now been built up into a big company that's owned by three buyout firms that specialize in buying companies and holding them and basically trying to make as much money as they possibly can. Earlier this summer, at the end of June, Asurion issued $3.75 billion worth of loans, loans that also did not are known as covenant-lite loans, loans that don't have a lot of covenants to protect the investors in them. And the proceeds of that $3.75 billion was used to pay each of the three buyout firms a $1.25 billion dividend. The banks then repackaged that loan into securities and sold them to investors all over the world. And of course, they blew out. They were so popular.
Now, this sounds important for a couple of reasons. Number one, they were using that money to pay off their investors. It wasn't like they were using it to hire new workers or to build a factory, right?
pure gravy, pure, pure gravy. I mean, it's like heaven for buyout firms who've, you know, owned this company for a number of years and you know, get a return on capital through the bond market, the loan market, without having to take the company public.
Huh.
Not so great for investors, unfortunately.
Well, the other thing that seems concerning about this is you use this term covenant light, cov-lite loans, also they're
yes.
known as, which sounds a lot like the loans that banks were giving to homeowners before the 2008 financial crisis, when borrowers really weren't getting vetted the way that they should have been.
Yes, it's similar certainly in that regard, although not quite that bad, because homeowners were not nearly as sophisticated in their analysis of the kinds of loans they were getting as people who invest in these so-called cov-lite loans. But covenants are designed to protect investors so that they can get early warning signals when things aren't going particularly well at the company that has borrowed their money.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can take action. They can force them to raise more equity. They can force them to sell assets to pay down debt. But without these covenants, there's no red flags. There's no early warning system. And so
fewer protections.
Investors, for their own protection, and,
no.
and they're willing to buy these loans without those protections. It's absolutely astounding. And according to leverageloan.com, nearly 77% of the estimated $1 trillion corporate loan market is now flooded with these cov-lite loans. Again, a signal that investors are so desperate for higher paying interest instruments, debt instruments, that they're willing to overlook many of the traditional protections that they have in the past would never have stood for.
Look, this corporate debt is also an issue with bigger companies as well, companies that everybody will recognize. You write about AT&T now saddled with $180 billion in debt after its deal with Time Warner. What's the risk there?
Well, and that ignores about another 80 or so billion dollars of other liabilities that AT&T has that aren't in the form of funded debt. Basically, it just means that AT&T is now the single largest, most indebted non-financial corporate issuer and is completely beholden to the health of the capital markets to refinance that debt, to issue more debt, to find a way to pay the lenders back for what AT&T borrowed from them. And so it's going to require a combination of AT&T continuing to perform operationally, you know, making enough cash flow to pay back that debt. But a lot of that debt comes due and is in excess of the cash flow that the company can generate. And so usually what happens is companies then are dependent on going to the capital markets to do that. But when you're as leveraged as AT&T now is, you are even more beholden upon the capital markets and the health of them. And capital markets do shut down occasionally. I've seen it many, many times in my business career. And that, you know, even if you're AT&T, you can't really refinance debt if the capital markets are shut down.
How does all of this unravel and become potentially a full-blown crisis? You mentioned this idea that access to credit could get much tighter.
It's like a switch. I mean, it's like what Hemingway said about falling in love a little bit at a time and then all at once. Same with when the bond market, when the capital markets get shut off. Everything seems like it's going along beautifully. The president can talk about how the economy has never been stronger. The unemployment rate has never been lower.
Stock market is way up.
Stock market is way up. And yet it's these kinds of excesses. You know, it may take something like Elon Musk and Tesla with, if any of your listeners have been following that saga and
his,
drama.
His interest in taking the company private and going into debt to do it.
He already has $10 billion of debt. This would require another $25 billion or so debt, even if it were even possible, with a company that has no positive cash flow, no way to really pay off that debt in any reasonable way, except dependent on refinancing it. And so it's that kind of thing that could trigger the market. And all of a sudden, people realize that they've been taking too much risk and they've been allowing too many covenant-lite situations or other situations to go on, thinking that the world, you know, the trees were going to grow to the sky, but they don't.
That's the thing. We think trees will grow to the sky until they don't. And so the question is, how do you convince the banks or these companies to put the brakes on this, you know, and do something different, maybe be more restrictive in the debt that they're issuing?
It's really tough. And it's really tough because the incentive systems on Wall Street do not give people a lot of credit for saying, hey, we're taking too much risk. People on Wall Street are rewarded to take big risks with other people's money. That has not changed after the financial crisis. That has not changed in 2018. And it really takes some strong leadership on Wall Street at the coming from the CEO level through the credit departments of these big companies to say, you know what, we're not going to issue these kinds of loans. We're not going to underwrite these risky securities. We're not going to do it. But unfortunately, on Wall Street, one firm can say they won't do it, or two firms can say they won't do it, but there's always a firm that is willing to do it. Yeah. The question is, when it goes too far, the market just cracks, as it did in 2007 with the mortgage market, as it did in 1991 with Citibank and the United Airlines buyout. Nobody rings a bell and says, this is the moment when it's over. It just happens.
And then the crisis is here.
Exactly. And then the markets shut down, and not even the best companies, not even the finest credits can get access to the capital markets.
That's William Cohan, author and former investment banker. Bill, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure, Peter. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's here and now. The soda giant PepsiCo has agreed to buy SodaStream. They make those tall, thin home carbonation machines. It's an attempt by Pepsi to diversify and to move away from sugary soft drinks, which consumers are moving away from, or in my case, trying to. Derek Thompson has some thoughts on all of this. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does every Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, great to be here.
So other people, have been buying less soda in recent years. We know this. And some cities, Philadelphia, Boulder, Berkeley, have put a tax on sugary soft drinks because of these health concerns. So how big an impact are these taxes and this general view that soda is unhealthy? How big an impact on big soda companies like Pepsi and Coke?
It's having a huge impact. Sales of soda are collapsing around the world. Here's one statistic. Per person, soft drink consumption is down more than 25% since 2008, down a quarter in the last decade. It's bad for Coke, as seen in the decline of almighty Diet Coke. And Pepsi specifically has seen declining sales for its own staples like Mountain Dew and Gatorade. So this is the twilight, I would say, of the age of sugar water. And if you're in the business of selling sugar water, you're looking for a life raft.
You're looking for the horizon. And what are some of the soda companies doing?
So, you know, this January, I wrote a piece in The Atlantic called Diet Coke's Moment of Panic. And I said, you know, products have jobs. And the job of Diet Coke has essentially been outsourced to superior beverages. So, like, hydration is a job, but that's been outsourced to bottled water. Bottled water consumption has tripled since 2000. And so these companies have gotten in to bottled water. Getting a jolt of energy, that's a job. But it's been outsourced to coffee and energy drinks. So these companies have also chased the trend into energy drinks and even coffee products. And then finally, the satisfaction of, you know, a cold liquid fizzing on your tongue, that job has been outsourced to seltzers. Mm. And so nothing is growing faster right now than sparkling water. Sales are up 40% year over year, just monster numbers. And that's precisely the trend that we see Pepsi chasing today.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Cross country, it's different. You know, here in the New England area, whole aisles can be devoted to seltzer water. Some parts of the country, they don't even have it, you know, on roadside places. So it's obviously big and huge, but still moving. And so let's get to the elephant in the room for many when they hear about SodaStream being bought by PepsiCo. SodaStream started as a British company, but the Israeli owners put a factory in an Israeli settlement in the West Bank, what Palestinians and their supporters see as illegal Israeli occupation. The actress Scarlett Johansson got flack for being a spokesperson for SodaStream. The company argued that they gave Palestinians jobs, but announced in 2014 they were going to move the factory. Is this part of why it's being sold? And can Pepsi shake that, which for a lot of people, it's stuck to SodaStream?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to me because on the one hand, SodaStream is popular because it has this positive moral valence, right? You're not drinking sugar. You're not using extra plastic bottles. You're doing something that's good for the environment, good for the world.
We should say they have these reusable bottles, so they're saving hundreds of thousands and millions of throwaway water bottles.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. It's great context. But at the same time, you also have the fact that, you know, pro-Palestinian groups said it represented support for Israeli occupation of Palestine. And so SodaStream left the West Bank, but it laid off many of its Palestinian workers, which only compounded the controversy because it was seen as punishing the Palestinian population. And so it's really interesting. You have this company that on the one hand people are excited about precisely because it seems like a moral alternative, but then it also has these moral questions that are anchoring it down.
Yeah. Well, and so long term, what do you think? I mean, other companies have tried. I think you told us Hummus or somebody, one of the soda companies tried. Pepsi buying SodaStream. Good move?
The honest answer is that I have no idea, but I think this is just an important bit of historical context. So the company, as you said, was founded in 1903 by a gin distiller in England. It was very successful. It took off the 1970s, 1980s in the UK, and then the fad faded. So it was bought by an Israeli company, taken over by private equity, and now rebranded. The fact that the fad faded is an important historical data point, because it suggests that just like drinking soda, just like drinking 5-hour energy, SodaStream itself could be a fad. And spending $3.2 billion on a fad is a very risky proposition.
What might be the next thing after making your own soda water? What would it be? You know, IVs?
IVs, yeah. I don't know. You know, we might just go back to sort of our hominid basics and just drink out of the tap.
What?
As crazy as that sounds, sometimes the thing I do in New York is put a glass under the sink, fill it up with water, and then consume that glass. Yeah, it might be all the rage, I think, in the next few years.
That is wacky. Well, actually, you know, we're joking, but let's hope we have clean water in the years to drink. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.